The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So what I had in mind this morning was to say just a few words, if I'm capable of that, and then opening up more to questions or comments, questions mostly. You know, if you have any questions, like to explore some aspect of practice, we could do that way. So the words are that in thinking about this as being, some people call it the holiday season. Sometimes it's called the season of peace, occasionally. And that nirvana, or awakening, is sometimes said to be characterized by peace. And peace is a very important aspect of this practice, aim of the practice. Hopefully we can become more peaceful people in many ways. But interestingly, the Dharma, so nirvana is sometimes characterized by peace, but the Dharma is not characterized by peace. The Dharma, it said in a very ancient kind of saying in Buddhism, the Dharma is characterized by nonviolence. Isn't that interesting? And then it's understood in this ancient Buddhist tradition that whenever you have a non in front of a word, it often implies the positive quality, what's actually not just simply the absence of something, but the presence of something, the antonym. So so nonviolence is understood to be compassion. So one of the qualities or the characteristic of Dharma is nonviolence or compassion. And so what's the relationship between peace and compassion, or peace and nonviolence? I think the Dharma here is meant to be the teachings of the Buddha, the practices the Buddha taught, some of the qualities that develop in a person, some of the patterns that unfold for people as they do practice. And that the Dharma, that teachings and the practice, is characterized by nonviolence. And what I like about this is that peace is a little bit, can be seen a little bit more as being just me. You know, that you sit in quiet and meditate and you become peaceful. Hopefully that peacefulness kind of radiates or benefits others as well. But peace has no quality in it of being interactive. And it's something very profound about that peace, non-interactive peace. The peace that's not defined by self, not defined by other, that's liberated from self and other, is a very profound thing. But the Dharma is interactive, is connected. And sometimes when people do Dharma practice, they forget that the Dharma is something that that has to do with relationship or interconnectedness. And that Dharma is characterized by compassion or nonviolence. And this reminds me of a repeated teaching of the Buddha, where he said a wise person considers what is beneficial for self, for oneself, what is beneficial for others, and what is beneficial for both self and others. And for a long time I thought this was just kind of emphatic rhetoric, self, others, and self and others, just, you know. But I think this idea of a wise person engages in their life with some concern, some consideration, but what is beneficial all around, not just for me. So it's not, certainly the Buddha cannot be criticized as being just kind of offering a self-centered kind of practice, because he was very concerned about how can we live our life to be a benefit of others as well. But then this very interesting statement, beneficial for self and others. And I started thinking about this some more this last week when I heard on the radio a discussion about vaccines. And so like a flu vaccine, or any kind of vaccine. But take the flu vaccine. So I could take a flu vaccine, and supposedly that's supposed to be beneficial for me. Great. But when I take a flu vaccine, I'm also, one of the reasons I do it is I have a little kid at home who has asthma. And it protects him. It's not good for him to get the flu. So I become a buffer, a small buffer, one-person buffer, between whoever does have the flu and my son because I don't get it. So if you know, if 80% of us in this room have the flu vaccine, we provide a big buffer for those 20% who don't. Now, some people who can't have the flu vaccine because they have immune problems, they have a variety of conditions that prevents them from taking the flu vaccine. So the 90% or the 80% of those people who do take it actually supports the people who can't take it. So it's beneficial for, so it benefits ourselves, but also benefits others. And the discussion was that when parents don't vaccinate their kids, which some parents don't do, because they feel there's all these mercury and dangerous stuff in the vaccine, it's a reasonable concern for parents to do, but to have. However, they then rely on all the parents' families who are vaccinating the kids all around them, providing a wonderful buffer. And so it's a little bit, you know, self-concerned. You know, I'm going to take care of my kid and let everyone else create a wonderful environment around me where I'm buffered from all these terrible diseases. So it's interesting how, you know, the interaction, the interrelatedness there that we have. And so how is it that practicing the Dharma or practicing living our life, how do we consider not self, but not just others, but also the mutuality, the interactivity of all of us, how we work together? And so here, coming here to practice at IMC, some people who practice in this kind of environment find it very beneficial to sit together with other people. And they feel supported by others. You know, some people say it's harder for me, hard for me to sit at home still for as long as I sit here. But here it's easier because I feel the atmosphere of the group. So, one example. So we're benefiting from all these, you know, so then people who feel that way are benefiting from the group. That's nice. However, that person who's getting that benefit is also providing that benefit to someone else. Isn't that nice? And sometimes people don't remember that. Oh, the fact that I showed up and sat here, I'm supporting someone else, and who maybe needs the support. And perhaps some of you are quite content and happy to meditate alone at home. And however, when you come here, you also, your presence offers a certain kind of support for other people. And so this mutuality. So the Dharma is a wise person considers how we benefit self and others. Practicing of generosity. Generosity is meant to be beneficial for you. Opens your heart, develops wonderful qualities, is a source of joy and happiness for you. And hopefully, clearly, generosity is beneficial for others. But it's also beneficial for the whole system, for self and others. Because as we create an environment of generosity around us, then people treat us differently, people treat their society differently. And I think that one of the things that we have here at IMC, I hope, is we have a field of generosity into which many people come and benefit because there's a level of trust and goodwill that is kind of built up as a kind of a community level, not just, you know, one-on-one or something like that. Am I making some sense to you? So the Dharma is characterized by nonviolence or by compassion, speaks to this interactive quality that Dharma practice is about. And so when we practice, I think it's helpful to consider how are we kind of interacting and how are we being supportive. When we do look at ourselves directly and practice, then the Dharma practice is characterized by nonviolence. It's a very helpful reminder. Can we be nonviolent or compassionate to what goes on inside of us, what happens to us? Can we meet what happens here? I was very touched. Recently I went to a class meeting, my son's class, parent meeting. And several of the parents, one in particular, spoke up and said, you know, I think that my daughter is one of the more difficult children in the class. And I knew from other parents that sometimes they talk in the bushes about that, you know. And so I knew that this young girl was a little bit of an issue. And here the mother sat there, said, you know, I think my daughter is one of the big problems in the class. And I'm challenged with my daughter. And we spend a lot of time at home trying to figure out how to work with my daughter, how to work with her behavior and what's going on. And as she spoke, it certainly opened and softened my heart towards her and to the daughter to hear that. But what impressed me so much was the very, very honest and taking responsibility, but kind of matter-of-factness in which this woman is willing to kind of expose herself and say, this is what I'm struggling with. As if it wasn't, almost as if it wasn't a problem. It was a problem to address, but almost like kind of undefensively, kind of a tremendous acceptance. And then it was very sad then to see that some of the parents responding to her didn't have the same broad acceptance. One parent spoke up, oh, you know, it really starts at the family, you know. And so here was someone who was willing to kind of say, this is my situation, being undefensive about it, kind of broadly accepting. You know, I felt this, you know, she was kind of as compassionate for herself and situation, and then she got, you know, stabbed a little bit. But I'm so inspired by people who can speak. This is a situation, you know. I'm neurotic, you know, or I'm afraid, or I have this issue with anger, and this is what I'm working with. And just, you know, there isn't any criticism or, you know, added animosity towards oneself, hostility for having it. This is what's going on. This is what I'm working with. Not acceptance in the sense that, oh, great, I'm just going to continue being angry. But yeah, I'm an angry person, and this is what, you know, my situation is, and I'm not going to be embarrassed or defensive about it, or I'm doing my best. So how can we meditate with that kind of approach, to have that kind of honesty about ourselves? Here I am. This is what the situation is. Not being defensive about it, not being offensive about it, but to meet it in this nonviolent approach, this compassionate approach. That's the quality of the Dharma, how to sit here with that. When we do that, that tends to be conducive to peace, how to have peace, and how to be peaceful, how to be peaceful about who we are and what we are. And my hope, and I think my understanding, is that that level of peace, nonviolent, peaceful approach, not being in conflict with what is one of the best avenues for discovering the peace of awakening, the peace that steps beyond the concepts we have, the limits we have, the boundaries we have of self, into this great kind of possibility of being alive without all these concepts and ideas that limit us. When the Buddha analyzed violence, he said one of the primary conditions for the arising of violence is people living in a lot of hard and fast concepts. So that being able to have the capacity of softening the hard and fast concepts and being relaxed. I like that being relaxed is a stepping stone to peace. To be relaxed about this and softening the concepts. And so when we meet the others, we don't meet them with hard and fast concepts, but rather we meet them with soft concepts and ideas that are flexible and malleable and open and willing to shift and change accordingly. So awakening is characterized by peace, but the Dharma is characterized by our compassion. So those are my few words. So now it's your turn. In our mutual interactive engagement of the Dharma, now I turn it over to you, and we'll see where we go.
Thank you for that talk. It was really great. And I'm off on another trip, but I think it has something to do with the season. Just thinking about joy and gratitude. And, you know, sometimes when I tune into my body, I notice obstructions in different places. And so sometimes I have an obstruction to the joy and gratitude that I'm feeling. And as I deal with the obstruction, I seem to deepen into joy and gratitude. So I'm wondering if you could just say some things about deepening into joy and gratitude.
Well, I'll tell you the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, it's I think it's to be expected that human beings will have obstructions and tensions and difficulties of a variety of different kinds, attachments, clingings, normal. And sometimes I'll sit with some tension in my body that I have, and it would be nice if I could just do the magic wand of mindfulness and just make it all go away just like that. But it doesn't usually work that way. It sometimes takes a while for it to kind of dissolve and settle and all that. But I get a lot of joy that I have a practice that can meet those things. So it's one thing to be concerned about how quickly they go away, how quickly they get fixed. But it's another thing to know, wow, I don't know how long it's going to take, but wow, I have a practice that can meet this and be honest by it, that has that offers me a path through it and with it, and helps me to find a place to be peaceful with it or compassionate with it. And maybe I won't succeed today, but I'm so glad that I have a practice. So that brings me joy.
Thanks.
And what that does is that it shifts a little bit. also involves a shift of attention, of focus, from the problem, from the object to the subject. And as I said somewhere recently, I don't know where it was, maybe here, but the there are three things involved in a problem. There's the problem that we have, and many of you can probably dream up, think of all kinds of problems you have. Most people, most human beings have problems. Which you call homo problematica. Or rather, hopeless homo sapiens. And so there's a problem, and then it's our relationship to the problem, how we relate to the problem. And then there's the subject, the person who has the problem. And most people focus on the problem. But if you focus on the subject, sometimes the subject can disappear. Then the problem, you know, goes away. So, you know, for example, I'm concerned that people see that I have a certain status, and then the problem is that people are not treating me with enough respect for my status. So I could address the problem of those people out there, I could educate them. Or I could look at the relationship and say, well, you know, they just don't know. They don't understand, and it's okay, I'll just leave it the way it is and be relaxed. Or I could look and say, look, Gil, you seem to be caught up in the status thing. Why don't you just dissolve that? So I dissolve the status thing, and poof, I don't have a problem with those people anymore. So when we focus on the practice, the Dharma, it helps us to step out of the orbit of the problem, and that we don't live in the problem anymore. And if we don't live in the problem anymore, then we can still address it and be responsible for it, but our identity is not tied to it. We don't define ourselves by that. So part of what we do is we shift the identity, shift our understanding of self in relationship to it as well. Does that make some sense? You're thinking about how it applies?
Let me think.
Yes. But it was a great question, your first question, deepening joy that way. And maybe other people here today will have other comments.
Because this is a season of taking vows or things we want to change with the new year or the solstice or something, I was reminded of a practice that a teacher somewhere in Marin County taught me one time. And her name was Wendy, and I don't remember her last name, and she wasn't the gardener. She was the Aikido teacher. And so every year
Wendy Palmer?
Right, exactly. Fierce woman. Wonderful. But anyway, every year she would take a quality that she wanted to work on, like generosity or kindness or something, and then she would remind herself all year that Well, if I were more kind, how would I have responded in this situation? Or if I was more patient, would I have said what I said? And remarkable that you remember how to do it, remember it all year. But instead, so that it gives you an avenue to make the practice of wanting to be more patient instead of just saying, I want to be more patient this year, and I want to be more kind this year, and I want to be more generous this year, that it breaks it down to some way that we might actually learn how to take more of that quality in.
Beautiful. Thank you. Did it bring you joy to do it that way?
When I remember to do it.
I really appreciate the comments that you made, Gil. And I was thinking about ease, and because you were talking about compassionate loving kindness, and then how some people respond in a way that's very maybe violent or more constricts. And so I was thinking, you know, I grew up in a very violent atmosphere, and I'm sure some people, whether they wanted to or not, they've been exposed to very severe violence in the form of war in their countries and things. And I found that by practicing a certain type of movement, I was really shocked because it was kind of like moving meditation, not Tai Chi, but something else. And I noticed, wow, you know, I never felt this ease or this spaciousness before because I was always doing things in such an extreme way. And a lot of my movements were like that. And so this, it was allowing me to feel more at ease and comfort internally. And I think that would lead to respond with more peace and ease and give other people that chance also to be who they are without responding in a way like you're saying, offensive versus, I don't remember the other word, defensive and offensive, but just coming from a place of spacious ease. And maybe I just answered my own question. I always do that. But I was going to ask, because it's a season of giving, and I was going to ask how to give to yourself, how to practice generosity toward yourself, and the comparison between generosity versus indulging, because the culture is always telling you, oh, you deserve this, blah, 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 and then what happens with addiction is that it gets psychologically reversed and it becomes the way to actually give in a way that's meaningful or filling the needs don't get addressed. They, you know, you start doing indulging instead of...
It's a great question. It's a fantastic question. The difference of between taking care of oneself and practicing in a way that, in this way, focuses on self in a way. And when is that healthy and when is it narcissistic? When is it self-indulging? And one of the things I find myself as a teacher is that sometimes hard for me, even when people come and talk to me about their practice, for me to notice, to see, this is only occasionally, don't worry, you know. Is he talking about me? but it's hard sometimes to see, the difference in a student between when they're narcissistically self-involved with their practice and when it's actually a healthy self, you know, personal mindfulness. Because you sit here, you know, in a retreat, for example, in meditation, you sit and you close your eyes, and the primary thing you notice is what's going on in this psychophysical being here. So you start noticing your tensions and your activity of your mind, your feelings, your emotions. And so then it makes, you know, that's what you're grappling with and you're working with. And so you come and talk to the teacher, you talk about, you know, I had this experience, this is what happened to me. Seems reasonable. But then sometimes it just feeds into this narcissism of self, and I'm the most important, you know, it's all about me, and you know, negotiating the self and all this. And So how to negotiate that is, anyway, as a teacher, I find it occasionally a little bit hard. Sometimes it's not hard. Sometimes it's clear. It's narcissistic. But sometimes I find, oh, how do I find that difference? And so how do we, so I think just knowing that there's an issue, I think, is important. And I don't think I have any good answer for you. I wish I did. But I believe that if it's narcissistic or self-indulging, that if a person is sensitive, if the mindfulness is strong, they can feel how that's off. They can feel the suffering or the tension that's part of that, the restriction or the tightening or the hardness that's involved in that. But it requires being very, very calm and sensitive. So if you do like the movement thing you can do and get really calm and relaxed and peaceful, that's place, from that place, then you might be able to see that when it becomes selfish or self-indulging in some way, there's a way in which there's a tightening up that happens, a limiting, a constriction, boundaries get set. But when the practice is leading to a greater peace that's more open, there's less boundaries, there's less things to protect, less constriction, less tightening. So that's the best I've come up with so far.
One question of the example that you had when I guess there's a child, it's a family, and you're admitting your child is difficult to another group of people, or I guess other families or whatever. And I was wondering, is there any way to sort of the person who's admitting difficulty to somehow to have a strategy to deal with the people who seem to be inflexible about their attitude? That's my basic question.
What's the strategy? Yeah. I think there's two general categories of strategies that I could think of sitting right here. One is not be too concerned about what they think about you. You know, so I think not being concerned about being liked, or you know, people don't like you, or the people say all kinds of things, and so not be so sensitive to it. Okay, well, you know, it's unfortunate they're saying that. It's unfortunate for them. It's a little unfortunate for the group. It's unfortunate for me, but I'm not going to pick it up. I'm just going to let it be. I'm going to be like an umbrella. And this is they're the rain, I just let it wash off. So there's a very healthy way of doing that. Just, you know, so that's one strategy. The other strategy, which is much more difficult, I don't know which is more difficult, but the other strategy is to have the social skills, the communication skills to work with that. So it might be as simple as saying, could be, I can imagine sometimes, very wise to simply, it's not offensive. It's not criticizing them for saying what they did, but the parent might have sat there and said, "Oh, ouch," and that could be really wise. Oh, and then everybody, oh, had an impact here. But if the person said, "You don't know what you're talking," you know, that's really disrespectful of me, or you know, then suddenly it's in conflict. But if you say, "Ouch," then I think it's all thing kind of, you know, has a chance. So, ouch could be a very sophisticated form of communication. But there might be, you know, there's the whole learning social communication, learning techniques of how to talk wisely, and I'm still learning. Betsy.
Thank you for your talk, Gil. I was reminded of an example. You used the example in the trade-off between self and others in context. I was reminded of an early example, that I learned here very poignantly from Tan Jeff, who has taken many more than the five precepts. But he was talking about trading off values or letting go of a personal value that he had taken, one of the five precepts, when he was at dinner, a guest in an element of hospitality, and he said, although he had taken the precept not to kill and therefore made the personal choice not to eat meat, that in the circumstance that he was presented with a plate of meat as a gesture of generosity on behalf of the host, that he would gratefully accept that gift. So trading off a value that was dear to his heart in exchange for accepting that which was offered with a grateful heart. I found that to be the most moving tribute And I just wanted to share it as it occurred to me to be a second example to yours of the issue around vaccination. Thank you for your talk.
Thank you.
So I recently read an article in Tricycle that relates to this idea of peace. And what was the...
Nonviolence, and compassion.
Yes. It was about a Zendo in New York where they combined martial arts with mindfulness. And one of the students that worked his way up to become a teacher was very violent. He was surrounded by violence. And they were quite used to being searched by the police. And they would react, you know, before they were involved with this endo, they would react in a violent or upsetting way, and the police would get more aggressive. So he decided, this particular student who worked himself up, that he was just going to submit to the search because he recognized that the police would stereotype all these ghetto kids. And by submitting to the process, I mean, what he had to let go of was the self-victimization. And by letting go of that, the police, he noticed that the police got more relaxed and became a non-issue, a non-event. So this was using skillful means, both in from a peaceful aspect of sitting meditation and using martial arts to channel this violent tendencies, in contrast to the nonviolence that also manifested itself by his willingness to let go of the self-victimization.
Great. Lovely.
This is a question about receiving Dharma. That in our center here, we have various kinds of views of Dharma, talks that, from different positions or traditions. And I particularly have a problem with Zen talks, which we quite often have. And I've had more than one occasion when the person next to me turns and says, "Wasn't that a great talk?" And I'm like boiling mad because it was so obscure I couldn't figure it out. So I struggle with this because some of it is personal preference, that I like the straightforward, but I still struggle with it a little bit in terms of how can I relax that and find the Dharma in Zen.
How can you find the Dharma in Zen? maybe an indirect kind of way of approaching your question, starting indirectly. Probably the most common comment I get at IMC about the Zen talks that are given here is the comment, I thought it was a great talk, but when it was over, I didn't know what they had talked about. So there is sometimes an obscure quality or a complex quality to the way Zen talks are offered. And some of it might be very skillful, some of it might be unskillful on the part of the teacher. That's what they do. And so I think, you know, in terms of for you, it might be more, you know, it might be nice to find that Dharma in the Zen, but it might actually be more meaningful for you not to look at the Zen and the teaching, what's going on there, let that be what it is, but to look at what your relationship is to not understanding. And there might be a rich field, a rich number of relationships that you're forming with that you'd be useful you to look at and grapple with until such a point where you could come to IMC, hear a Zen talk, and say, "That was obscure. I have no idea what they talked about, but I'm okay. I'm not angry. I'm not upset. And what happens inside of you that triggers you to get angry?" And I'm not saying it's your situation, but it could be that someone could feel like, "I don't understand what's going on here. This means that I'm somehow at fault. I'm not smart enough. therefore I'm getting angry, frustrated with myself, and so now I'll take it out on the speaker because must be there. Someone has to be a blame for this suffering I'm feeling. So to look at that, and it might. So I think the Dharma for you, it might be more deeply found by looking at your relationship to all this, by trying to discover what's there in Zen. Now, once you've come to that place where you can peacefully listen to a Dharma talk, which is maybe even problematic, let alone obscure, then perhaps you're in a better place to pull apart, find the pearls that might be in there. That makes some sense?
Yes, thank you.
Now to answer your question most directly, how do I find the Dharma in Zen? This is one thing I learned, at least from when I was practicing Zen and listening to Dharma talks, maybe you don't find it in the words, but you find it in how the person is. So some people are tracking the words really carefully, the logic of the words, and that's what they look for. They want to try to understand, but sometimes in Zen, it's what the person's showing up there and they give the talk, what they're manifesting, how they are. That's where the Zen is being conveyed. Zen's not being conveyed in the meaning of the words, but in the spirit, the manner in which the person's there. So maybe if you don't listen to the words, but listen to the, something more obscure, something more. More personal, or something more personal, something more kind of you listen to the some of the inner qualities of the person that are being expressed. I remember many years ago, some 25 years ago, hearing a talk by Les Kay, who's the abbot of the Mountain View Zen Center, and I was so inspired by the talk. And what inspired me was what I could feel coming through, or what I sensed. Was his, by that point, 25 years of real strong intention and practice. And to feel someone's intentionality, 25 years of really strong intention around practice, that's what really, inspired me. What he actually said in the talk, I don't remember. To this day, I don't remember. No idea what he said. But I still have this palpable feeling of this man with this very strong intentionality there. And someone else, it's their... I remember there was one priest at Zen Center, Tom Girardeau, who gave us, he was giving a Dharma talk, and he brought with him, a copy of the early edition of The Inquiring Mind. I think that's what it was. And I'd never seen anybody at Zen Center get up and read, it was a Buddhist newspaper, read an article in a newspaper as his Dharma talk. I mean, you kind of like you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to read. You're not supposed to, even supposed to have notes. Back when I was there, you're supposed to just kind of just show up, but and just be yourself, right? And but I had this, he had this for me. He had this quality of just acceptance of just being. This is what he was. He wasn't trying to be anything special. He wasn't trying to be a special Zen teacher, he wasn't trying to manifest anything. And in that self-acceptance, for me, it was just being there, and it was actually more self-accepting. And I don't remember at all what it was he read, but his ease in which he just was just there and was meaningful for me.
I remember going to one of your hindrances retreat, and it was on sensual desire, and you had us doing an exercise. Talking with another person, and that person was talking for 10 minutes, and then you had us not saying anything for 5 minutes. Mm. And then that was my turn in doing 5 minutes of silence. And I realized how beneficial it was, because for the first time, really, I realized how much information was coming my way. And having 5 minutes to sit with that information, it to me gives me a lot of peacefulness. Mm. And then when we have difficult feelings in life, it's a lot of information coming our way. And often we want to react to it right away, But I realized just sitting with it kind of retreats and finding refuge within myself, then I could find peace. And then I was able to blossom and go back and open up because I dealt with it. And often the peace we can find is when you take the time, you swallow, you digest, you kind of retreat yourself, and then you can open up again and share things.
Beautiful. Very well said. Thank you very much. There's a, sometimes in our kind of extended circles, there's the instruction in speaking, wise speaking, to listen, pause, and then speak. And something very rich can happen in that pause. So, thank you very much, and thank you for the year and for the coming year, and particularly thank you for the mutual quality in which I feel supported by you, and we all support each other. And I really feel like in the Dharma, Dharma is something we share. And really what should be sitting here up on the podium is the Dharma, and I should be sitting on the side. Because the Dharma is our teacher. The Dharma is what we share, and the Dharma is what we create in this interactive, mutual, beneficial way in which we support each other and practice together. So I feel very fortunate to be able to practice with all of you who come here, and I look forward to another year of it. Thank you.